Sahanavavatu, Sahanavunaktu, Sahaviryankaravavahai, Tejasvinavaditamastu, Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
So let's chant this from the beginning. Just repeat after me. Okay?
Om Pratasmarami Vidisamspuratmatattvam. Om Pratasmarami Vidisamspuratmatattvam. Satchitsukam Paramahamsakatinturiyam. Satchitsukam Paramahamsakatinturiyam. Yat swapna jagara shushuptam avaiti nityam. Yat swapna jagara shushuptam avaiti nityam. Tad brahma nishkalam aham nacha bhuta sangaha. Tad brahma nishkalam aham nacha bhuta sangaha. Vatar bhajami manaso vachasam yagamyam. Vatar bhajami manaso vachasam agamyam. Vacho vibhanti kila yadanukrahena. Vacho vibhanti kila yadanukrahena. Yanneti neti vachanair nigama avochan. Yanneti neti vachanair nigama avochan. Tandeva deva majamachita mahuragriyam. Tandeva deva majamachita mahuragriyam. Pratar namami tamasav paramarka varanam. Pratar namami tamasav paramarka varanam. Purnam sanatana padam purushottamakhyam. Purnam sanatana padam purushottamakhyam. Yasminidam jagadashesham asheshamurtau. Yasminidam jagadashesham asheshamurtau. Rajwam bhujangama iva pratibhasitam vai. Rajwam bhujangama iva pratibhasitam vai. Okay. Vatar namami tamasaha param arka varanam. Purnam sanatana padam paramar. Param arkavaranam. Purnam sanatana padam purusha uttama akhyam. Yasmin idam jagat ashesham ashesha murtau. Rajvam ujangamaha iva pratibhasitam vai. So, Pratar Namami, Pratar, in the morning I prostrate to Namami, Pratar Namami. Tamasaha, Tamasav Param, that which is beyond darkness. Tamas is darkness. Tamas means, except for Rajas and Tamas, you know that Tamas. Tamas also means darkness. In the sense of that darkness, it means Ajnanam. So that which is beyond ignorance, or that which is beyond darkness, tamasah param. So I prostrate to, I do namaskars to, I bow down to in the morning, that which is beyond darkness, which is arka varanam. Varanam means color. Arka is the sun. So which is like the sun, which is luminous. Say the color of the sun means the luminosity, the sun which shines like the sun, which is self-luminous like the sun. So the Atma is often likened, it's two things it's likened to. It's likened to the sun as a drishtanta, like an example, you know, to make you like a comparison. It's compared to the sun because the sun is self-luminous. Nothing needs to come and light it up. It is its own light. And not only that, its luminosity lights everything up without it having any kartruktvam, any type of doership, or any type of involvement in that act of lighting, because it's luminous, everything in its way and that falls within its path is lit up just by its luminosity. Not that it is a doer or a karta saying, let me perform this act of lighting up the sun, of lighting up the world. There's no karta twin, there's no doership there. That's why the sun is such a powerful example. Also, with that example, we bring in the sun being self-luminous, lights up everything with no need for something to come in and light it up. That's very important in understanding the nature of yourself in reference to, say, the mind and the sense organs, which we ascribe knowership to. We ascribe knowership to the mind, right? Like, does the mind knows the self? And so is the mind the conscious entity which needs to illumine the self? Or is it because of the self that the mind is illumined? Well then, if the mind itself is not a knower, how can the self be known? Right? These are all the kinds of questions that come. The self need not be known in terms of its own swarupa, in terms of its own nature. It's self-luminous. So we don't need the mind or the sense organs or the universe, for that matter, to light up consciousness. Consciousness is already lit up. So in that regard, no means of knowledge is necessary. You know, it's like for the sun, do you need to bring in a luminary to light it up so that the sun can be known? No, it's its own light. So this is not where we use the sun example to show the self-evident nature of the sun, that you don't need another pramana, nor can another pramana, any pramana, come in and illumine the self. Nor does the self need it because it's consciousness, it's self-shining. So this is not the problem. This is not where the self-knowledge comes in. Self-knowledge comes in not to give you an experience of the self. See, this is a key issue here. Self-knowledge doesn't come in to give you an experience of the self, which is what we're used to having to do when we gain knowledge. So just to explain, like with that painting there, my mind needs to take on the form of that painting. Right? So I have to gain the experience of the painting. Right? If I'm looking this way, I have no experience of the painting. I have to look this way. My mind, with the use of my eyes, has to gain the experience of the painting, and then I can learn all about the painting. Right? But unless my mind knows the painting, gains a vritti, a thought modification of the painting, no knowledge is available. So the mind first has to, using the sense organs, gain a vritti of the painting, and then the consciousness illumines that painting and we can know it. That's how we think of knowledge, and that's how knowledge works in the world. You know, in terms of subject-object relationship, in terms of gaining the knowledge of something which itself is not self-luminous, right? It's away from me. Here, I don't need to gain the experience of the self first in order to gain knowledge of it. Like, I have to gain the experience of the painting first in order to gain knowledge of it, and if I don't, the painting's not there. I could have some sort of indirect knowledge of it or something. But I have to gain that knowledge. Here, in reference to yourself, you don't need to gain the experience of the self like I need to gain the experience of the painting. Because yourself is consciousness. It's already its own experience, not in terms of a subject-object, but in terms of its own swarupa, its own nature. It's self-luminous, self-evident like the sun. Okay, so that isn't what... I don't need to gain the experience of the self. It's already there, completely. The problem is not that. I am ignorant of the nature of that experience. I'm not ignorant of the experience, the self-experience, because it's self-evident, self-luminous. I am ignorant of what that self-experience is. Is the conscious being that I am, is it an effect of the physical body? Is it a product of the physical body? Is this conscious being that I am subject to birth and death? Will it die when the body dies? Is this conscious being that I am belong just to me? What is its relationship to the conscious being that you are? No knowledge there. What is the relationship of this me, this conscious being, to Ishvara, to the self, to the whole? That's where the ajnanam is. The ajnanam is not in the sin that is the, in the self experience. It's in the relationship of the self. I say self experience just not as that I'm experiencing it as an object, but just because it's self evident, the me. The problem is that the me, this conscious being that I am, because I don't know what it is in relation to the body, the mind, the sense organs, to others, to Ishwara, to whether or not it's subject to birth and death, I don't know. And so because there's an ignorance there, the mind, which always enjoys consciousness, does take, the conscious being that I am, to be it. So the mind says, I am a conscious being. I, the one who is subject to all of these moods and, you know, and to moods and emotions and to thoughts and, you know, levels of intelligence and all of these ways I talk about my mind. I am this mind that is always changing, always fluctuating. This mind is me, is the conscious being. That's what we call anyonya abhyasa, this mutual superimposition, where the mind becomes the conscious being, and the conscious being becomes the mind. The conscious being is thinking and changing and going, having ups and downs and emotions. And the mind becomes the existent conscious entity. It's called mutual superimposition, anyonya abhyasa. This is the ajnanam. And so now atma, the self, has become limited to the mind, which is then existing in the body. And then you don't know, will the mind die when the body dies? All I know is I'm existing in this body, using these sense organs, and since I'm this body, or maybe I'm a soul that transmigrates. I can believe that, but I don't know for sure. All these types of doubts are all a product of ajnana. Come. And then I'm, of course, different from you and different from the rest of the world, and I'm different from God also. This is dvaita. This is caused by the ajnanam of not of the mind having the self experience as I am a conscious being without knowing what that experience is. So technically we call this the difference between samanya jnanam and vishesha jnanam. Samanya jnanam is when you have the general knowledge of something and experience of that something without knowing what it is. It's just general. You don't have a particular knowledge. Like we use the rope snake example for that. Samanya jnanam is the bends of the rope, you know, but you don't have the ropeness. You know what you know the shape, you experience the shape, missing the ropeness of that shape. Samanya jnanam is the perception of the shape. Vishesha jnanam is the recognition of the of that shape being a rope. So here you have samanya jnanam of your own being. I'm a conscious existent being. That conscious existent being, that bottom line me that is present to all experience, is Brahman. That's the ajnanam. That it is Brahman, that it is the very being of the whole creation, that's the ajnanam. Not the self, not the self-evident recognition of me. See what I mean? So this is really important, because if that's not known, then in your mind, when you're having to become, to know yourself, you have to first gain an experience of yourself. And then learn what that experience is. So how do I gain an experience of myself? Well, we'll meditate. Meditate and travel to a state of being where I can experience myself. But that means myself isn't here right now. So that means they have a different definition of self, which is something else, somewhere else. But self-knowledge, atma-jnanam, is knowledge of who you are right now, that you, that when you go to the teacher... In the Upanishads, you know, the student goes to the teacher and goes to the feet of the teacher and gives the, you know, offering. The Panitsamihi, you know, goes with those sticks in hand and makes his offering also, and then says, please teach me. In so many words, says, please teach me. Who am I? He's not talking about some self up there, some imaginary self. Who am I? This person. Who am I really? Does this person who's standing before you, this me, this conscious being that I am, am I this body? Am I a transmigrating jiva? Am I subject to death? What is the truth of me, this one who is here? Is there anything about this me, is this me, anything about me that is free from death? What is my nature? they're talking about the self that is already present, present with Ajnanam. That self already being present is totally, fully your self-experience. So you are self-evident. You're the one, the conscious being that is there present, shining, in absolutely every experience that you have. So this me that is present to every experience that I have, who am I? Who am I? Am I a product of this body? Am I subject to it, etc.? So here it starts out, I prostrate to that one who is self-luminous like the sun. Arkavarnam, I am self-evident, self-luminous like the sun. The sun is very important. And this one who is Arkavarnam is tamasaha param, is beyond darkness, is beyond ignorance, because from the standpoint of the self, not only as the sun is all knowledge and ignorance, all darkness and light illumined. Right? From the standpoint of the self, I am aware of darkness. Like say we turn out all the lights and it's nighttime. Can't see anything, it's just black. I illumine the blackness. I illumine the night. I illumine the daytime. I illumine what I know. I illumine my knowledge. I illumine my ignorance. Like if I ask you, you know, do you know Chinese? We say that because it seems like the hardest language. Do you know Chinese? You'll say no. How do you know you don't know? I know that I don't know. Because I illumine both what I know and what I don't know. You know? Have you ever been to the highest peak of the Mount Everest? No, I've never been there. How do you know? I know, I promise you I know. I have not been there. What you know and what you don't know is illumined by consciousness. That consciousness is beyond light and dark, it's beyond all of the opposites, it's beyond Ajnanam. It illumines Ajnanam, it illumines ignorance. So every morning when I get up, first thing, I prostrate to the Atma, the self, which is beyond light and dark, which is self-luminous like the sun, which is Purnam. Purnam comes from the verbal root pr, which means to fill. It's a past passive participle with a long r. It takes that ur, long ur, so Purnam. Purnam means that which is full. Swamiji uses the example like, you know, if you have a glass and you fill the glass, you fill it with water. And so it gets up clear to the top, and then you keep adding drop, drop, drop until it's so full on the glass that it has like a little, you know, it's like a little bubble on top of the glass. And you keep drop, drop, drop until there's one last drop that makes the glass overflow. Right? Well, before that last drop, that is Purnam. Right? It cannot be any more full. You know? And so Purnam is often translated as that which is full. But we use it in the sense of that which is infinite. It means there is, you can't go any farther than that. You can't be any more full than that. There's nothing beyond that. That's Purnam. So now I prostrate to that self which is self-luminous like the sun, right? Which is beyond all darkness, which is absolutely full, which is infinite, Purnam. And which is Sanatana Padam. Sanatana Padam, Padam means the very thing that it is. Padam means not feet here, it means the pada, the actual place. The place of Brahman. Brahman which is free of place. But the Brahman itself is Sanatana. Means it's beginningless. It's infinite. Infinite in terms of time. There's no, it's free, totally, it's Sanatana, it's Nityam, it's free from time. So that Brahman which is infinite and which is timeless. It's free from time, beginningless, timeless. Sanatana Padam. And it is Purusha Akyam. It is called the Purusha. it goes by the name of Purusha, which to me, see, Purusha, we're talking now about Brahman, who is Ishvara, right? When we say Purusha, Purusha means the person. Forget, there's different etymologies for it. One is the one who lies in, resides in the Puri. Puri means the city. This body is often likened to a city. So that conscious being which is here indwelling in the city of the body. But here Purusha is talking about the Atma. And so now we're talking about my salutations to the Purusha, you know, the one who indwells in the city, which is the body, whose nature is self-evident consciousness, which is beyond darkness, illumines darkness itself, and which is Purnam, infinite, you know, boundless, and free from time. So that's what Purusha means. It's the person. What makes that? I look at it like this. What makes you a person, a being? You think of yourself as a person, a being. You are the what makes you the person. It's the not something that's in by nature inert or jada. Jada means inert. This body is by nature jada. It's enlivened right now, but when it dies, it's just inert. It'll go back into the elements. Whatever is objectified and whatever comes and goes in your experience, that's not you. That's not the Purusha. That's not you, the conscious being. What makes you you is you, the conscious being. That is the self. That's the Purusha. That Purusha is limitless, is changeless. Now, that, so now when you think of that is yourself, not the body and the mind and the sense organs and the thoughts and the moods and the emotions, all of the things that are coming and going in one's experience. That's not the Purusha, that's actually Maya. That's really Ishvara's Upadi. That's the Jiva Upadi that is part and parcel of Ishvara. But the Purusha, the self, is the one that is free of those Upadis. The one that is not limited by any Upadi. It's limitless. So that means yourself, the Purusha, the person, you the person, is the self of Ishvara. You the person is what makes Ishvara a person. So you feel that you're a person. So I could say, now, say if I say like this, you take yourself to be a person. And what if I use it in Sanskrit? You take yourself to be a Purusha. Why do you take yourself to be a Purusha? What is the Purusha? The Purusha is that conscious being, the me, that in a sense indwells only in this sense, from the standpoint of the body, the mind, the different vrittis, the thought modifications are going through the mind, all of my different perceptions. I am there, present to all of those vrittis, to all of those experiences. I, the Purusha, I, me, the person, I'm there. Now, it is this I, me, the person, that is the one there, present to the entire creation. So just like I can say I am from a standpoint of Ajnanam, I am this body. I am the self of this body. Right? That's what every samsari will say, I am the self of this body. That's what, and as long as you have a body and mind and sense organs, that's what you experience. I am the conscious being and the very self of this body. Talk like that. You are the Purusha. You are the person that so-called indwells the body. But once you recognize that you, the person, don't exactly indwell the body, like if you drop a pearl in a vase, the pearl is indwelling, you know, in this vase. You drop a little pearl in there, and there it is, hidden in the vase. So like that, we drop the little pearl, Atma, into the body, and it's indwelling in the body. It's not like that. Because actually there is no indwelling. The indwelling is only from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, which which is enjoying the consciousness, but which itself, but the consciousness is not, my consciousness is not bound by it. That's why you're present to all of the experiences that make up this body, mind, sense, organ, and world, but you're not changed by them. The experiences, all experiences that you have, come and go in you as though But as they come and go, you remain. And that's your experience. That's viveka. All the experiences that you think that you are indwelling actually enjoy you fully, but as they move on, you don't. So you are actually the pervasive self of all of the experiences, but those experiences don't touch you in any way. And so the one whom the experiences are is totally present and pervasive to the experiences, but is not touched by the experiences, that is me, the Purusha. That Purusha is Ishvara. That self that is pervasive to all of these experiences from the standpoint of the body, mind, and sense organs, it is that very me that is Brahman, that is Ishvara, the self of Brahman. Right? And what does that say, then what does that do to Ishvara? It makes Ishvara a Purusha. What makes Ishvara a Purusha, a person? It's not the Upadi, not the Maya Upadi. What makes Ishvara a person is the self. The self, that same one self that makes you a person, right? And so you know Ishvara very intimately because the Purusha which Ishvara is you. So the self, that's what's so one of the most, for me anyway, one of the most beautiful or comforting or whatever word you want to use about this knowledge is that you in fact are never away from Ishvara. This body, mind, sense organs, every thought that you have, every vritti that you have, every experience that you have, you know, is illumined by Ishvara. So you can say, Ishvara is me, right? You can say, I am Ishvara, and then people don't like to say that because it seems so arrogant. I am Ishvara. But then you're identified with the upadi, right? You're identified with the body, mind, sense organs. The I, in fact, is Brahman, which is Ishvara. Brahman, which is the self of Ishvara. Right? You know, if I say, you have to, if I have to be careful how I talk now, because if I say, I am Ishvara, right, then you have to remember who that I is. If I say, I am Ishvara, it's the Purusha, the me, the conscious being, is the conscious being, which is the self of Ishvara. Ishvara also, what makes Ishvara a being is the Purusha, not the Maya, not the Maya Upadi. What makes what the truth of Ishvara is Brahman. The truth of my being, the Atma, is Brahman. So if I say I am Ishvara, I'm talking about what Ishvara really is. What Ishvara really is, the Satyam, right, which is Brahman. Who is Brahman? Brahman is the Purusha, which is my being. So Ishvara is the person. Ishvara is really the person, and I know clearly who that person is, because that person is my very self. The person of Ishvara is my very self. And what that means then is that the Ishvara Upadi, the infinite manifestation of this entire creation, is my manifestation. It's not somebody else's. There's not some self over there that we call Ishvara. Like Ishvara has his Purusha. Ishvara is one person, I'm another person. There's one person, and that one person is Ishvara. The self of Ishvara is what we call Brahman. That Brahman is the Atma. There is no Atma other than Brahman. And so when your very intimate sense of being a conscious being, I'm a conscious being, that conscious being is Brahman. That what you say is the Atma, myself, this Atma, myself. That self, in fact, is only one self, which is Brahman, which is the self of the whole creation. So that means that this whole creation is yours, not somebody else's. When that's understood, that's also, to me, something very comforting, because this whole infinite creation, Swamiji now uses these words, which I love, this Maya Upadi, is an infinite manifestation of knowledge. Right? So the creation manifests and goes into unmanifest condition, manifests, goes into uncyclical manifestation. He says that manifestation is, how you can relate to it, it's a manifestation of knowledge. Like if I ask you right now to think of a meadow, you know, the meadow was in an unmanifest condition, and now you bring it into manifest condition. So the manifest, the meadow, now please think of a meadow, that is manifest in meadow knowledge. And when that knowledge manifests, then there is a meadow which you are aware of. So he looks at the entire infinite creation, the Maya, the total Maya, when it's in unmanifest condition, it's avyakta, it's like deep sleep in a sense, it's just not manifested, it's not manifest. And when it comes into manifestation, what is that like? It is known. So this whole creation is something like the manifestation of infinite knowledge, all of which is known when it's manifest. That is the Maya Upadhi. And so this whole creation, well, they don't really use this word in the Shastra, Swamiji has used it sometimes, but it's like a cosmic mind. You have an individual mind. I ask you to think of a meadow. You think of a meadow, then that meadow is illumined by consciousness. It exists in consciousness. So that's my meadow mind, right? But for Ishwara, for Brahman, for the self, for the total Maya Upadhi, when this manifests, then like your meadow is known, the entire infinite creation on every level is known. That's why it's like why I say infinite mind is because the whole thing is pervaded by consciousness and is a Purusha. But the Purusha is Brahman, is myself. So this whole entire creation is infinite knowledge, whereas as a part of this creation, I have limited knowledge. And so when that is really, when you deeply understand that so that you live by that, then the whole creation knows what's going on much better than you do. Ishwara has the total picture. You have a limited picture. So within your prarabdha, the prarabdha of your particular life as it unfolds, you have limited knowledge. You can't see around the corners. You can't see all of the different cause and effect sequences that are coming into play at this given time. You have no idea because your knowledge is extremely limited compared to the total. But from the standpoint of you, Ishwara, everything is understood. Everything has its place. Everything has its unfoldment. And it's infinite. It's your infinite knowledge from the standpoint of yourself as the Atma, as Brahman. And so I kind of enjoy that I can trust when I don't know, I can't see around these corners or know why things happen the way they do. I have a trust that from the standpoint of the total story, from Ishwara's perspective, you know, that there is much more wisdom there. And so I can become very interested in seeing how all of these things are going to play out. And often we are kind of allowed to see what we can't see in foresight, we can see in hindsight. We can appreciate meaningfulness much more easily in hindsight. But it gets to a point where you can expect and enjoy the unfoldment of meaningfulness in foresight. See what I mean? You can look forward to the unfoldment of the creation as it unfolds the meaning and purpose of this particular sequence of events. Even though you can't see it, you can see it, you know, you can discover it as it unfolds and you can enjoy that type of that unfoldment when you have an appreciation of yourself being more than just this body, but in fact yourself is the self of the whole. So there's not this foreignness or separation from yourself and the creation, because you are, in fact, Ishwara. So now it says, having done this unfoldment, it says, that one who is Purnam, who is timeless, who is the very Purusha, who is self-evident, is on that one, yasmin, idam jagat ashesham, this idam, jagat, universe, world, ashesham, without any remainder, means this entire manifestation of the creation on every level within duality, is on this one who is asheshamurti. Asheshamurti is on in the locative to go along with the yasmin. So on that one who is asheshamurti, whose form, whose nature leaves nothing out, it's ashesha. The very nature of whom is ashesha. Nothing is left remaining. So to understand that Brahman, that self, is the self, is the very being, is the substance of everything. There is nothing which lies beyond it. So there's nothing that lies beyond, in this entire creation, the substance, the being of the entire creation, is only Brahman. Its murti, its form, its nature, is ashesha. It leaves nothing out. There's nothing that is excluded from Brahman. So this entire creation, this entire duality is pratibhasikam. It is something which is projected upon, which appears, you know, on that. As though if I see you are different from you or different from you, there's a manifest, infinite manifestation of duality. This infinite manifestation of duality appears upon Brahman, but in fact is nothing but Brahman. Brahman is its very self. It's like saying the word pratibhasika means appears or is projected upon. It's just a word to talk about Maya. So say if I took like the example of, again, if I take the clay pot, does it work for me to say really that the pot is projected on the clay? It's a way of saying that the pot itself has no independent being on the clay. Say it's projected, or the pot, the clay appears, you could say like this, the clay appears as a pot. What they're trying to say is that, how are you going to account for the pot? What are you going to say about the pot? There's really only clay there. There's no separate pot. What is really there is clay. You can't say that the pot is something other than clay. Even though it's useful in all of this, in terms of the reality of what is there is only clay. So now, in reference to this universe, how are we going to account for it? Now, do we say, okay, this universe appears upon the self, or the Maya is a projection of infinite knowledge that only has for its substance the self, you know? There is no creation. There is no creation other than consciousness. The only thing that's really here is consciousness. There's nothing else. Because you try to find something else here within this duality that seems so stable and everything, and it is stable within itself, but if that's not the point. It can be extremely stable within itself. The dream is very stable within itself for the one who's within the dream. That all makes sense within the dream. It's only when you wake up from it that you see the mitya. Mityatva of the dream. So now here in this creation, so okay, here's this stable creation, you know, with infinite manifestation of knowledge, so much order, so many laws, we have math and science and so many ways to, you know, analyze this creation, but we're analyzing it from within the creation. Now I ask you, what is actually here? In spite of all this order, all this beauty, this infinite manifestation of knowledge, what is it actually? What is it made of? And then upon analysis of this creation, you really can't find anything here because everything is infinitely divisible. You can't find a substance here. Everything in the creation is coming into being and going out of being. You try to find something here, and you can't. Everything is just a conglomerate. So Swamiji will say there's nothing here but names. It's names upon names upon names, or names within names within names within names within names within names. There's no substance. He'll take like the lamp. This lamp, that's a name. But within the name lamp is the name rod. A rod and a bowl, you know, and a light fixture and screws. These are names within names. Then you look at a screw and then the screw has ridges and this and that and this. Everything that you see is just a name, which is then defined by other names, which are defined by other names, but you can never get to the thing. You can never get to the thing. But the thing is always there. The thing is not a thing within the creation. The thing is being itself, is consciousness itself, which everything continually enjoys. Names within names within names within names within names within names. But all of those names have only one substance, which is there from beginning to end. And that substance is consciousness, is me, is existence. Is the Purusha, right? So, like the clay pot, how you can't account for any beingness, anything about the pot, except the clay, which is what is actually there. Like that in this creation, you can't account for anything that is here other than the consciousness, conscious being, which is not objectifiable, but which is me. Right? I am the self-evident consciousness, which is the very existence, the very being, the very substance of this whole creation. So that's the asesha murtau. Yasmin asesha murtau. On which, on this self, whose murti, whose nature, whose form, not form in terms of shape, but whose very being, leaves nothing out. Means that this whole manifest jagat is, in a sense, superimposed on it. But it's not the jagat that is the thing. The thing that is the substance that is actually here is that which is there pervasive to the whole thing, and that is Brahman. So then it says, so this on which limitless being, on which this whole jagat without remainder, this entire creation without remainder, it is superimposed on this self, just like Rajwam, Eva, like Rajwam on the rope, the Bhujangama, the snake. Just like the snake is superimposed, projected on the rope. The rope, the murti of the rope, is the asesha murti, means that form rope totally fills the snake. There is no, not even the smallest iota of snake apart from the rope, right? The snake projection doesn't overlap onto the earth. The snake projection is the rope. See what I mean? The rope fills it completely. So this rope, in fact, though, is only Maya. The snake has no independent being at all. You see that? Its only being is the rope. So like that, this creation, the entire creation, has no independent being. I am the Satyam. I, the conscious being, am the Satyam. I am the independent being, the non-dual me. But this me is independent. And it is real. It doesn't come and go. It doesn't shift. It's the one non-dual thing that actually is. This creation is me. Right? But I am free of it. The whole creation is me because it enjoys the Satchit. I am its truth. I am its clay. But I am totally free from it. So this creation comes into existence, into manifestation, is sustained, resolves, comes into manifestation, is sustained, and resolves. In whom? In me. There is no part of the creation that goes anyplace else. Right? I am its truth. Time and space itself come with the projection. Just like if you imagine a meadow, the space comes with the meadow. The sky comes, the sun comes, the meadow comes, the trees come, the jivas come. And then the activity, with the change in activity, goes in the meadow. The meadow has its own time sequence. The time belongs to the meadow. The space, the dimension belongs to the meadow. Right? The whole duality belongs to the meadow. When the meadow comes into dissolution, the space dissolves, the time dissolves, the duality dissolves, and what is left is just what is actually there, is me. That's why, for you, you can have an intricate meadow imagination, and when it's withdrawn, nothing happens. Whole meadow is withdrawn. Dream is the perfect analogy for that. You have this, you know, ragingly real dream, totally involved in it. You wake up from the dream. The whole dream universe is gone. All the people are gone. They're all destroyed. Everything's gone. Nothing has happened. Nothing has happened. Because nothing has happened to you. That's what death is like. Nothing has happened. Because nothing happens to you. But for you, there is no death. Not even a little bit. Nothing. Zero. There is a change of scenery. But there's not a change of you. Right? If you lose this physical body and you're as a jiva, you're traveling to different realms of experience, that's also not going to be strange for you because you've been doing it from beginningless time. But that's a different situation. That's like, say, I've flown back and forth from New York or to India so many times that it's nothing. Because you know? I know the territory. And that those kind of travels will continue going on, and when you drop this body, you know, that you're still there as a transmigrating jiva, and it's all a familiar territory. Just like the dream itself is, that's very weird, actually, the dream, but it's very familiar territory. It's so familiar you don't even think about it. You dream, you try to leave this world behind, and you leave the body behind, you take another body, you know, totally another situation, no problem, there's no problem at all. You're totally used to it. Don't even think about it. Take it totally for granted. Deep sleep, being without the experience of any universe at all, not even of a hankar, not even of somebody who has a subject-object relationship. Wonderful. No problem. Beginningless time. It's never... There's nothing strange about it. There's nothing strange in the same way. Nothing strange about transmigrating to different levels of experience. You've been doing it since beginningless time. But from the standpoint of yourself, it's even different than that. Yourself never changes. And that's why also all of these changing experiences are fine, because you are still there. They're yours. Whatever the experience is, on whatever level, in the creation, whatever loka it happens to be on, whatever transmigrating is going on, no problem. Just like the dream is no problem, because nothing has happened to you. There is not the slightest flicker of birth or death for consciousness. Consciousness is not objectifiable. Your being is not objectifiable. It's something that comes and goes within creation. Like everything in creation is coming and going, subject to birth and death. Yourself, there is no such thing. And so you will never, there'll be changes going on, but you will never experience death. It doesn't exist. So all of these things will change. Body will drop. All of this, these kind of things will happen. And the mind can be in tremendous fear and all of that if it doesn't have any idea what's going to happen to me. But actually nothing happens to you. It doesn't matter if you're jnani or not. Still nothing happens. It doesn't. There is no such thing as death. That's the reality of it. And so here it is that changeless self, which is you, which is the you, the me, which is the self of the entire creation. So it says, just like a rope, just like a snake is projected on a rope, this whole creation is projected on me. There really is nothing here but me. That's the verse. And then he ends this with just this, he ends this Pratyasmarana with a praise of these three verses. He says, Shloka Trayamidam Punyam, Shloka Trayavibhushanam, Loka Trayavibhushanam, Pratakale Patetyastu, Pratakale Patetyastu, Sagachet Paramam Padam, Sagachet Paramam Padam. He says, Shloka Trayam Idam. This group of three verses, Shloka means a verse, Trayam means a group of three. Idam means this. Shloka Trayam Idam. This set of three verses that we've just done. This set is punya. These three verses are punya. They are auspicious. They are a blessing. They hold the nature of reality in them. So these three verses are punya. They are loka traya vibhushanam. The three verses, the content what is unfolded here, these verses are ornaments. They are ornaments for the all three lokas, all three worlds. This bhuloka, for the, you can take it as the bhuloka and the intermediary space and swargaloka. This is the truth of all of the worlds. It's also the truth of the three worlds in terms of waking, dream, and deep sleep, of all in that sense too. Of all levels of your experience, this is the truth of it. And then from a samashti, in terms of all of the different realms in this manifest creation, this world that we experience, intermediary lokas and swargaloka, the heaven worlds, this is the reality of all three worlds. So this set of three verses are a blessing. They ornament, they decorate, or they're the ornaments, they bless all three worlds. Pratat kale, in the morning time, kala means time, Pratara means morning. In the morning time, patet, yaha. He who studies these, patet means to read them, to study them, you know, to recite them with knowledge. He who understands these, who studies these, who gains knowledge of these, in the morning, patet, say, studies these, the one who does that, saha gachet padamam padam. That one attains, goes to the padamam padam, the supreme pada. The supreme padamam padam, the supreme padam is Brahman, the reality. How do they go there? Through jnanam. You can't go to Brahman because you are Brahman. So what is the going, the gachet? It's anugachet, it's like adigachet. It means but that crossing over, reaching Brahman is a reaching through jnanam. You are Brahman. But how to get there? Because if I'm Brahman, I don't know it. So to get to Brahman is to know I am Brahman. So the going there, the reaching there, is a reaching through knowledge. So these three verses, the one who studies these three verses, that one, definitely, gachet is in the potential. So if one studies, it's a conditional, then if one does this, then definitely one gains, one goes to that supreme padam. The padamam padam is what is actually there, is the padam of Brahman. So a lot of times when verses are, especially in a Prakarana Granta, a work that really unfolds what is being told in the Upanishads, dilates it, at the end they'll have verses like this to make sure that if you study this now, if you really study this and understand this, this is the pala, this is the fruit that you will get. So it's meant to make you say, okay, if that's so, then I'm going to study this. This is important, and I will study this so that I can get that pala. So if you were to, but you know what, with these verses are so beautiful. If you were to study these and understanding these verses, then they will take you to Brahman through removing the ajnanam, the ignorance that stops you from recognizing yourself as Brahman. So that's this verse. So let's stop there. Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om.
Just a little question that maybe helped my perspective. How are you supposed to correlate this meanness with like all these swirling galaxies that go out for billions of years? I mean, huge universe.
You know, the way to understand that, I think, even though it's very, very impossible actually for us to have that, see that Ishvara Swarupa. Remember the, I guess it's the 10th chapter of the Gita, is it? Where Arjuna asked Krishna, since he realized he's Bhagavan, please show me the whole fish, you know, the whole Swarupa, the Ishvara Swarupa, the whole creation. And so Krishna granted him that. And Arjuna just totally freaked out. He said, okay, that's enough. Impossible to really conceive of that. But think of it now from your perspective, if I were to ask you to just visualize a universe, just imagine, you know, a universe, or imagine, you know, the earth floating in space. You can do that, and the whole thing, very simply, rests in you. It is not a matter of size. Size is only relevant from within, as from someone within the imagination does size matter. For the one for whom the imagination is, the entire imagination, you think of it from this standpoint of a jiva, of the infinity. You can't even imagine it.
Yeah, and it sticks hard. You know?
But that's why you have to kind of loosen yourself up and by in understanding that any imagination that you have, whatever size, small or large, it makes no difference. Size is irrelevant from the standpoint of your being. It's relevant from the standpoint of those within it. Like you can think, like for instance, if you think of a bacteria in your little toe, you know, really, or it's just take a bacteria or a cell, just one little cell in your little toe. What chance on earth does it have to recognize me as in the form of this body? Not a prayer. You know, it barely even if it gains knowledge of the smallest little segment of the little toe, is doing a lot. And so it could say, you know, how is it possible to even understand what this little universe surrounding the little toe is? No way, it's not possible. And so you have to understand the whole thing from the standpoint of consciousness itself, which has no time or space. Consciousness is not big or small, it's infinite. There is nothing else at all. But it's not, doesn't have a right side or a left side, an up or down, it doesn't have any parts. It is total and complete, but it is all that is there. But what is there is free of time and space, dimension. It's just there is nothing else.
There's no dimension.
There's no dimension because there's no space. There's dimension in the creation. There's a right side and a left side. There's depth, all of this. But that all belongs to the Maya. From the self is, it's not non-existent, it is, it's your very being. You know, but it doesn't have anything to do with time or space. In fact, in meditation, you can recognize this. When you just recognize, differentiate the objectifiable creation, the objectifiable experience that you can have from your being, which is not objectifiable. And then you just ask, what size am I? What color am I? You know? What are my boundaries? The words don't apply. Those words don't have any place to land. Now, from that self comes the meadow imagination. In the meadow imagination, there's dimension, there's time. In the universe, your universe imagination, there's dimension, there's time, there's objectivity, there's things, all of that. But for you, from your standpoint, the one from whom the imagination has come, size is totally irrelevant. So say the size is infinite. But that's my size. I am infinite. That's totally my size. There's nothing strange about it. Just like you can say, as a human being, your size is huge compared to a little cell or bacteria. But not to you. You're not huge to you, you're just you. So the infinite creation is just as Ishvara. That is what Ishvara is, but from your... But to even understand that, that also puts things in perspective. Because even though each one of us, from our perspective, we have a life, and the life lasts for a particular period. period of time, you know? And we have relationships and purpose, but from the standpoint of the whole, that was way too long. You can't make a small enough blip. But from our standpoint, it's all meaningful. The fact that in terms of the whole, it's not even a blip on the screen, you know, because it's so minuscule compared to the whole. Still, within this minuscule reality, it's all meaningful. You know, which is just, it's a fantastic thing. It doesn't diminish the meaningfulness, even though it's only a blip that can't be registered in terms of the time of the total. Nevertheless, it's meaningful and full and complete. You can imagine the whole creation is to be in that way. So it's good to do meditations.
Yeah. But, you know, when I imagine a dream, that's manageable and it seems right. But then when I take it to the stage of the infinite cosmos...
Well, instead of taking it like that, use the dream and recognize that you're the self of the dream, and then look at the situation of your life, your experience of the creation, and stick yourself in it and see that all as a meaningful dream, as Ishwara's dream. Don't try to extend it beyond what is impossible, you know. You can intellectually make an infinite extensions.
Yeah.
But that has its own use.
Yeah.
But you can also just put yourself in what you can imagine.
Yeah.
You know? And understand all of that as Ishwara.
Yeah, I got it. That's nice.
You know, you were talking about a mutual superimposition of the conscious being becoming the mind and the mind becoming the conscious being. Do you remember
that's what I was talking about, what we call anyonya adhyasa, mutual superimposition. That's born of agnanam.
It's born of agnanam.
Agnanam.
I see.
And say, if you think of the red hot iron ball, the fire becomes round and heavy, and the iron ball becomes red and hot. That's the ignorance. That's the mutual superimposition. They take each other to be. So even though the Atman, the self, is not committing any mistake, because the self is just pure infinite consciousness, so there's not any mistake or agnanam from the standpoint of the self. It's, you know, it's tamasah param. It's beyond, right? Ignorance. It just illumines whatever it is, the reality. It doesn't have ignorance. But from the standpoint of the mind, the self, because of ignorance, the self becomes a thinking emotional being, takes on with the qualities of the mind. Okay? Takes on the qualities of the body also, and of the sense organs, but we're starting with the mind. It takes on the qualities of the mind so it can be, you know, happy, sad, upset, smart, stupid, whatever qualities are of the mind. And then the mind gets the qualities of being a conscious being. It takes on the nature of the self, and the self takes on the nature of it. So the mind becomes a conscious being, and the conscious being becomes happy, sad, etc., whatever the mind is. So it's what we call mutual superimposition that's brought about by ignorance.
So you get kind of caught up with each other.
Absolutely. The mind takes itself to be the conscious being, and takes the conscious being to be, you know, emotional, thinking, emotional being. Mm-hmm. And then with knowledge, with the whole teaching methodology, there's that viveka discrimination that has to take place, you know, where I realize that actually the body is an object that I illumine, that I watch change. The sense organs are also objectifiable. That I watch them, I'm aware of them. The mind, I'm aware of. That's part of the teaching, to do that viveka discrimination, so I can discriminate my own presence from these things that the mind has superimposed on me. Mm-hmm. Anyonya means anya, anya, other, other. And so anyonya, the word anyonya means mutual. And then adhyasa means superimposition. So mutual superimposition. Like red hot iron ball is a good example for that.
When you're doing the waking dream and deep sleep, the point of that is partly to distinguish yourself from those three states. There's a little more to it than that, right? I mean, it's not exactly Dukdrisha, right?
No, it's not. Well, it is in a sense, but start. Sometimes this is a good. There's different progressions you can use when you're unfolding to students. But say if you start with Dukdrisha, when you're starting with Dukdrisha, you are planted here as the waker in experiencing this world through your sense organs. That's where you start, because that's where we are. Now, when you go through that process of differentiation by objectifying everything that can be objectified, starting from what your sense organs perceive external to the physical body, you start with that. Then you realize that those same sense organs actually perceive, the five sense organs perceive the physical body. So the knowership goes to the sense organs and the body becomes known. Then you realize that the sense organs themselves are known. And so then the knowership goes to the mind, the knownness goes to the sense organs. Then you realize that, well, the mind itself is known. And the knowership goes, the knownness goes to the mind, the knowership goes to the sakshi, to awareness. And you can throw in the ahankara, moods, emotions, relationships, space itself, all showing all of these things that are objectified. And then who is the objectifier? The self is the sakshi. So once you get to the sakshi, to awareness itself, okay, now you have the whole creation actually, including your body, mind, sense organs, objectified. So now all of this belongs to the creation. Now you have to look at what is your nature. Well, and how do I differentiate your nature, the nature of the sakshi, the witness consciousness? What is it? After it's been differentiated from all the things that you've identified with, now you have consciousness which is free of all those things. And so now there's the Atma. Now that Atma we have to recognize as Brahman. Because there's no way to differentiate consciousness from consciousness. If space itself has been objectified, right? So I'm not my body, I'm not my sense organs, I'm not my mind, I'm not even space. All these things are objectified, and all of us do that. I'm not my knowledges, I'm not my ignorance, I'm not my relationships, all objectified. Now, me, the conscious being, is left. For all of us, that's true. Then I say, okay, what differentiates, at this point, what differentiates my consciousness from your consciousness? So then we see there's only one consciousness. There's one universe, waking state. One waking state in which this body, mind, sense organs are a part, and one consciousness. We still don't know. We haven't analyzed the consciousness to resolve it as mitya yet, but right now we have one waking state, one consciousness.
Consciousness to resolve it as mitya?
No, the waking state. We haven't resolved the waking state as mitya yet. But say now you're just left with this one consciousness. Consciousness I am is consciousness you are. Okay, now we can bring in, we can keep working on that and work on the mitya toa if we want to. Or we can bring in another prakriya, which is called the avastha traya sakshi prakriya. Avastha means a state of experience. Avastha traya means the group of three states of experience, waking, dream, and deep sleep. So this avastha traya sakshi is the witness, the sakshi, of the three states, the group of three states, waking, dream, and deep sleep. Now, why that's important is because it drives home the freedom of my being. Because at this point, now we've, through Dukdrisha Viveka, you know, and you have to tell these things with a lot of elaboration and staying for a while in each state, because in each level of differentiation, because it's new to a mind that doesn't know this. This is totally new, this bringing about this differentiation. So you have to let the mind sit with that. It's like the elephant dancing on the little stump. You have to be patient, you know, and let the mind sit there at each stage. Okay, so then, now the thing is, you've recognized, oh, I am free from all of these things. Then you look, this is the waking state. Then you say, well, this waking state, in fact, you know, this waking state of experience that you experience is actually totally replaced by the dream state. Right? When the waking state is there, right, then I am the knower of the waking state. But when the dream state is there, not only is the waking state not present for my experience, but the waker in the waking state is not there. Right? Here's the waker. It's the, you know, the Vishwa, and this is Vaishvanara, or Virat. This is the whole waking state, and here's the individual within it. So when you move from the waking state to the dream state, both the waker, the knower in the waking state, and the waking state are gone. You are not gone. It's your dream. But your dream replaces everything you had identified with as you in the waking state. Right? So it's kind of puts a nail in the coffin in a way. You know, because you're still there, but you've easily assumed another body or not even bothered to assume another body. You're just the Ishwar of that way, of that dream. Right? But there's no sense of anything strange happening. Your waking state, your dream, but the dream replaces the waking state, and you're still very much there. There's been no death experience, no change. It's my waking state, my dream. Then you go to the deep sleep. When the deep sleep is there, there's no waking duality, there's no dream duality, nor is there any knowership. This is very important because we always think of, for me, to be a knower, but actually the knower-known relationship requires a jiva, or at least requires the maya upadi, which is pervaded by sattva, so that whole maya upadi reflects. It's like an infinite mind. So you can have the dream, but at least there's duality. You know, it's your story. Or you're a character experiencing the dream as a character within it. But in the deep sleep, the whole mind is in avyakta. It's gone into its causal condition. And now that awareness, there's no death for you. You don't think, oh, I'm going into dream in deep sleep. We love the deep sleep. Because in the deep sleep, there's no problems there. All problems are gone. You know, there's just me, and the problems have gone to sleep. Right? So now I am, and the consciousness illumines that avyakta, that unmanifest condition, but there's no activity within it. There's no chit-chat, there's no knower known, there's no knowership. But when I come out of that dream, that deep sleep state, I remember it, and I have a memory of it. I can talk all about it. I can, like, just like I've been talking about it, because I remember it. I recall it. But when that condition is there, everything's in unmanifest condition. So there's no chatter. There's no see or seen going on. So now so you can spend a lot of time analyzing these states and moving from one to the other. But it's all. It is all taking you through a particular logic called anvaya vyatireka. This logic goes like this. When this is, that is. That's the anvaya. That's the positive correlation. When this thing is, then that is. The negative is when this thing is gone, that is gone. That's the vyatireka. Positive correlation, negative correlation. If that's the case, when this is, that is. When this is gone, that is gone. Then there's a real relationship. There's a dependence. But what about you have this, it's like this. When this is, that is. When this is gone, that still is. That means the vyatireka doesn't hold. So that's satyam mitya, really. So when I am, I'd say when the waking state is, I am. But when the waking state is gone, being replaced by the dream state, I still am. When the dream state is gone, replaced by the deep sleep state, I still am. So you start out with the positive anvaya. When the waking state is, I am. When the dream state is, I am. When the deep sleep state is, I am. And everybody says, yes, 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 that's true. Now, but when the waking state is, I am. But when the dream state is, I am. But the waking state isn't. Right? The dream state replaces the waking state. The deep sleep replaces both of them. And yet nothing happens to me. Right? So that's the anvaya vyatireka. It makes you recognize that yourself, in fact, has no sense of identity even with the body, with the physical body as the waker of this world, or with the dream body, which is so much you in the dream state, or with just being in the deep sleep state when there is nothing going on at all. That also is not a problem. You don't require the self of identity that says, oh, look, I'm deep sleeping now. There's nobody in the deep sleep that's saying, oh, look, I'm deep sleeping. There's no ahankar. The whole thing is unmanifest, and you're fine. And so you recognize through these three states of experience your freedom, that in fact your self is not touched by the coming and going of these experiences. Who you are can't be not experienced, because it's you. Right? Whatever you're not, that experience can come and go, but it's not intrinsic to you. What is intrinsic to you can't be taken away in any form, because it's you. But anything extrinsic can be present or not present. And so what is that? The whole waking state, everything in it, subject and object, dream state, everything in it, subject and object, deep sleep state, that state of complete ignorance. It's not to, you're not dependent on that either. You see? So this isn't just another prakriya. We need all of prakriya means the teaching methodology. We need all of these teaching methodologies because the mind has to see this from these all of these different perspectives. You know? And then we have all the satyamitya. Satyamitya is basically clay pot along with a rope snake. But you use these illustrations to make the mind see what you're actually talking about. Say, I'm talking about the satyamitya, you know? I have to, if I bring in the clay pot, then you'll say, oh, that's right, that's what you mean. Bring in the rope snake, oh, that's what you mean. That's why the drishtantas are so. Drishtantas are these illustrations that are so important. Remember earlier I was saying how we use the sun is one that we use for the self-luminosity, for the sun. It's just, it's all illustrations are limited because they exist within duality, but still they're very helpful. The other one we use in terms of the elements is akasha, space, because space pervades the whole creation and is untouched by it. So even though space isn't the Atma, it has certain qualities to certain gunas that we can use as an example. Right? Even though every example is limited, there are certain things that we can use to highlight what we're trying to say about the nature of the self. It's called upamana. It's a particular pramana called upamana, similarity, comparison, that we use. You can use it negatively or positively. Yeah. Like the body is subject to birth and death, the Atma isn't. The Atma, the self, is not subject to birth and death like the body is. But, you know, so there's negative upamanas and positive ones. It's also very, very helpful to make you, to point you in the direction of what the Upanishad wants you to recognize. Because what it wants you to recognize is already completely here. But because of the ajnanam and the superimposition that's born of that and is beginningless, you know, we have to look at it. We have to look at these things differently. We have to separate everything out in a way. It's not just automatic, because the mind has seen the creation and itself in this way since beginningless time. It's not like there's a prior condition. Ignorance is the prior condition. There's no prior condition. There's beginningless ignorance.